Who are the White Helmets in Syria? Are these recipients of the Right Livelihood Award, a true humanitarian group seeking a cessation of violence, or are they agents of imperialism? How are the American people and the world being propagandized into supporting another military crusade? How do the Syrian people view their president, as well as the Western and Russian forces colliding within their country? Why has the political and diplomatic rhetoric over Syria coarsened in recent weeks? Can popular pressure stop an attack in Syria, which could escalate into a confrontation with Russia? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we spend time examining recent events in Syria and how attitudes in the West are being manipulated by demonization campaigns both against Russian President Putin and Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. We'll hear a replay of a recent CFUV interview with Rick Sterling, an independent researcher and member of the Syrian Solidarity Movement. We'll hear from Canadian Mark Taliano, retired high school teacher and writer who returned recently from a visit to Syria. And we'll hear from broadcaster and commentator Stephen Lendman. On this week's program, Brinksmanship over Syria on a war footing with Russia. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 30th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Washington has unmasked plans to arm militants with manpads to oppose the Russian air grouping operating in Syria. The unnamed sources one more time blamed Russia and Syria for airstrikes on militant targets and emphasized that, quote, the opposition has a right to defend itself and they will not be left defenseless in the face of this indiscriminate bombardment, unquote. The same day, the Syrian government forces launched a full-scale offensive on the militant-controlled eastern neighborhoods of Aleppo City. The operation started after 5 days of intense air and artillery strikes on militant targets in the besieged areas and after previous gains in the Sheikh Saeed neighborhood. That comes from the article, U.S. and Allies Arming Al-Qaeda Rebels with Portable Anti-Aircraft Missiles, or MANPADs, to be used against Russian Air Force, posted September 28th, originally appearing at South Front. An environmental working group review of government water analysis data reveals that 75% of drinking water in America is contaminated with cancer-causing hexavalent chromium, also known as chromium-6. In a widely publicized report, EWG warns that 200 million Americans are right now being exposed to this toxic chemical in their water. This is on top of our own efforts at epawatch.org, where my lab tested hundreds of municipal water samples from across the country and found high levels of lead and other heavy metals in 6.7% of samples. Hexavalent chromium has been found in the tap water of 31 out of 35 cities sampled. Of these cities, 25 had levels that exceeded safety standards. Sadly, even if your water is not contaminated with any of these substances, it may still be unsafe to drink. That comes from the article, 75% of drinking water in America is contaminated with cancer-causing chromium-6, by Mike Adams, posted September 28th, originally appearing at Natural News. Fresh video evidence from the province of Latakia indicates that Russia has likely increased its air grouping operating in Syria. The video, entitled Syria Army Relaunches Offensive Against Militias in Latakia, and posted by Ruptly on September 24, 2016, shows the Su-25SM attack aircraft supporting an advance of the Syrian army against terrorists. There have been no Russian Su-25SM aircraft in Syria since the partial withdrawal of the Russian air grouping from the country. The Syrian Arab Air Force does not have such warplanes. This means that Moscow has deployed Su-25SM strike fighters in order to increase the air power involved in operations against terrorists. That comes from the article, Russia deploys more warplanes in Syria. Air operations against U.S.-sponsored terrorists, posted September 28th, originally appearing at South Front. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. To start the show, we'll air this interview conducted by CFUV's Chris Cook for Guerrilla Radio with a Syria solidarity activist, Rick Sterling, on the topic of Syria's white helmets.
Well, hopes for a tremulous peace agreement in Syria were blown to smithereens last week by a sustained American air attack against Syrian army units protecting the town of Deir ez-Zor from ISIS or Daesh. The blitz, which U.S. officials later said was all a case of mistaken identity, killed more than 60 soldiers outright and was followed by what seemed a coordinated ISIS incursion. Now, the result is an end to the peace deal and ratcheting up of the propaganda battle for hearts and minds here on the home front. To that end, prepare to hear lots more about Syria's famed White Helmets organization, already recipients of a prestigious Right Livelihood Award. The shadowy group are also being promoted for a Nobel Peace Prize. Rick Sterling is an independent researcher, writer, and member of Syria Solidarity Movement, an organization that has mounted an online campaign to pressure the Right Livelihood Foundation to reverse its award decision. Sterling's articles can be found online at Counterpunch, Consortium News, Dissident Voice, and at Pacific Free Press. Rick's also an active member of the Task Force on the Americas at the Mount Diablo Peace and Justice Center. Welcome back to the program, Rick.
Yeah, hi, Chris.
Well, okay, now, Rick, up here in Canada, you know, our national broadcaster, both on the radio and on our nation's premier news program, the National, they're right down with the Right Livelihood Foundation singing the praises of these white helmets, yet you and the Syria Solidarity Movement, and others too, have a less heroic view of them. What part of the story is the Right Livelihood Foundation and the CBC and other Western media missing here?
Well, they're basically missing everything. Unfortunately, they bought the propaganda hook, line, and sinker. It's a very slick campaign. It's a feel-good message. It sounds really great. These unarmed volunteers who are, you know, going in and rescuing babies and doing all sorts of wonderful things. It's a carefully crafted propaganda campaign to demonize the Syrian government, at the same time to promote the opposition in Syria. I'm hoping that some listeners will go to the change.org website and in the search engine there enter white helmets, and you'll see our petition calling for the Nobel Peace Prize to not be given to them. You'll also see the petition calling for the Right Livelihood Foundation to retract the award that they have given to the White Helmets, and we've got a very clear explanation. There's about 10 basic facts about the White Helmets that are at the Right Livelihood Award petition. It's pretty concise. We've also got references. There's some video links, and it's very objective and factual. And I can talk for as long as you want, Chris, about what's wrong with the white helmet.
Well, Rick, you know, I can't tell you how important the CBC is in Canada. Only in American terms, imagine NPR if people actually listen to it, you know? I mean,
it's
super influential. And a couple of days ago, one of the most influential program called The Current up here, one of the flagship radio programs going coast to coast, featured a man named Raed El Salah. He is the so-called leader of the White Helmets. Can you tell me a little bit more about Raed? Who is he?
Well, Raed is a Syrian. He speaks Arabic, so I don't know how they're interviewing him in English. I guess with a translator.
It was translated.
He doesn't speak English. But why he was selected, I have no idea. What we do know is that the White Helmets basically works only in the sections of Syria which are controlled by the terrorist groups, primarily the Al-Qaeda branch, the Nusra branch in Syria. That's where they work. They have a big media team, photographs and doing videos with the White Helmet stamp on it. And that's appropriate because the White Helmets are basically a media operation. They're basically trying to influence public opinion. They even have a cat video where some White Helmets are feeding sardines to stray cats. And they complain that the homeowners abandoned the neighborhood and all the kittens. Well, that points to the fact that the parts of Aleppo is a big city. It's the biggest city. It was the most populous city in all of Syria, a couple million people. But in the 90% of the population lives in the government-controlled section. There's perhaps 10% living in the part of Aleppo that's dominated by the terrorist groups. But the point is that almost all the civilians abandon there. They leave there because they don't like the way the terrorists are basically abusing people, imposing a lot of rules and regulations they don't like. They're very sectarian, which is contrary to the popular sentiment and the popular wish in Syria.
Well, in the interview held on the Current, Raed al-Salah says, we tried to get an okay. He was asked about where they operate and why, not why they don't operate in government areas, but the implication was there. And he said, well, no, we can't get in there because the Syrian government won't allow us to operate in areas that are under their control. What about that?
That's just another flat-out lie. They're actually now the so-called White Helmets. The original name was Syria Civil Defense. It was begun 3 years ago in 2013, and then a marketing company in New York rebranded them as the White Helmets. It was begun by a British military contractor named James Le Mesurier, whose company is based in the Gulf, but he got a contract from the U.S. and the U.K. governments to create this group. They began with training in Turkey. However, they began in 2013. Meanwhile, there is a real Syria Civil Defense, which began in 1953. In 1958, it was an original member of the International Civil Defense Organization, which is an international body. And they do work all over Syria. You just press 311, the equivalent to our 911, and you get a response from the Syria Civil Defense, the real Syria Civil Defense, or another emergency response team. So basically, the organization is a hoax. They are basically there to manipulate the public perception to give this feel-good sense to the opposition and to demonize the Syrian government. Mm-hmm. I have no doubt that there is bombing going on, and there are civilians being killed in this conflict as there are in any war. However, the overall situation is hugely different than the perception that we get from the mainstream media. And I'm thank you for telling me that. I'll go and I'll listen to the Current to hear what exactly Saleh says. And we should actually mount a campaign to have them bring on somebody to talk about the other side of the story here.
Well, they did.
The media is picking it up around the world. There was an Israeli TV station actually that did posed the question: are the White Helmets heroes or hoax?
Yeah.
And then there's other media that's starting to look into this now, especially since our petition online has many more signatures than the petition to give the Nobel Prize to the White Helmets.
Well, well, The Current isn't going to be that outlet here in Canada, at least because today they did have somebody else on, but it was on the not on the other side of the issue. It was a doctor whose name escapes me right now, and a purely emotional appeal talking about bombings going on in Aleppo today and yesterday.
We really need to hammer them on this, frankly, Chris, we need you and we need your listeners to call and complain to CBC. Tell them to bring on the other side of the story.
Well,
now, regarding the doctor, that's an you raise a really interesting point there, because there's a Syrian-Canadian doctor who's working in Aleppo in the government area, Dr. Nabil Antaki, and he is very eloquent. He's got good English, of course. And he can give the real perspective as to what's going on in Aleppo. So the CBC ought to be interviewing him to find out the story from there. That's where 90% of the civilians are. Instead, they're just focusing on the few civilians remaining in the terrorist-occupied zones of Aleppo at this point.
Yeah, well, I'll see if I can find the name of that doctor, but I don't think he was anybody that was going to give an even-handed view of that. But I don't.
Well, it might have been Salul, the guy from Syrian American Medical Society out of Chicago area, gets a ton of money from the U.S. State Department.
I'm not sure, but about. Raed El-Sala, earlier in the year, he went to the United States and was turned away. He was refused admission. The implication, it seems, was that he had some unsavory connections to maybe al-Nusra Front, maybe ISIS itself. Do you know any more about his contacts or why the U.S. government might turn him around at the door?
Well, I think it's a reflection of the right hand, partly not knowing what the left hand is doing, but also it's a reflection of differences of approach within the Obama administration. Unfortunately, the neocons and the hard right wing, the hard right hawks, are prevailing there. I think probably when Saleh's visa was revoked and he was not allowed to come into the U.S., that was probably some elements in the State Department that were starting to have second thoughts about continuing to support al-Qaeda. Right now, al-Qaeda is the fighting force. Jabhat al-Nusra is the name they use in Syria. They are the most effective fighting force. They're totally funded by outside powers, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Israel, the U.S. They're all in cahoots with them. Now, it sounds incredible, but there is just a ton of evidence to support it. In fact, a very well-known German journalist, Jürgen Todhofer, did an interview inside Syria that was published just a couple of days ago, where he was interviewing an al-Qaeda Nusra leader who was confirming that they're getting advanced weaponry directly or indirectly from the U.S.
Well, sorry, you caught me looking away. Well, Rick, Vanessa Bealey and Felicity Arbuthnot, two English journalists, independents, have written scathing accounts of the White Helmets' provenance, who they are and who they're working for. And I would think that it would be enough to put a warning flag up for big outlets like the CBC and the BBC in England and the American broadcasters. How are the White Helmets being treated in the media down south of our border?
Well, I mean, they're going from the supporting role to the front stage, actually. Now they're the witnesses to, the destruction of the humanitarian trucks a week ago or 8 or 9 days ago. The eyewitness who claims to have seen that it was a Russian jet fighter and some helicopters, that's a white helmet, of course. And now it's being claimed that the Russians are attacking the white helmet installations in eastern Aleppo. So they're really, especially with their they're receiving the Right Livelihood Award, they've gone, their credibility has gone up, and the media here is going, they're in a kind of a white helmet frenzy. So we are doing the best thing we can. We're working as hard as we can to bring a fact check and a reality check to that. And so I do hope that a bunch of your listeners will go to change.org, will enter White Helmet, and look at that petition, retract the award from the Right Livelihood, because, you know, there's 10 very simple, straightforward facts there that you can look at and you can confirm, as well as sources, and there's videos. Some of the stuff is almost laughable. Their cat video, for example. But they are getting a ton of publicity down here, and they really need to be exposed. This is on the order of, it's approaching the level of deceit that went on in 1991 regarding the incubators right. in Kuwait, that supposedly Iraqi soldiers were removing babies and leaving them on the cold floor and then stealing incubators from Kuwait. That fraud played a big role in swaying Congress and swaying public opinion to support a U.S. attack on Iraq. And the same thing, I mean, I'm sure that there's the danger of the same thing happening here. There's a real risk of the U.S. In cahoots with the UK and France and Turkey and Israel and Saudi Arabia and Canada, starting a full-scale attack on Syria. Syria it's an amazing struggle right now. You've got a secular independent country that's got kind of a semi-socialist economy. Education's free, healthcare's free. They were adamantly non-sectarian. They have respect for all the major religions, and it's been under attack for the last 5 years by some of the richest and most powerful countries in the world, who have used hundreds of thousands of mercenaries and fanatics from around the world, including hundreds of Canadians.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm talking today with Rick Sterling. Rick is an independent researcher, writer, and member of Syria Solidarity Movement. It's an organization, as Rick mentions, they have mounted an online campaign to pressure the Right Livelihood Foundation to reverse its decision of granting a Right Livelihood Award to the so-called White Helmets. And this is kind of a precursor, isn't it, Rick, to getting a Nobel? It's sort of like going and getting the Globes before the Academy Awards.
Well, I mean, they call it the alternative Nobel. They don't have a chance to win a Nobel, and I think the Nobel Committee is going to be, they are going to be hearing about this, and it's going to deter them. But we need to get the Right Livelihood to reverse their decision. And I don't know, they don't identify who their judges were, mm-hmm. But we need to reach out to their leaders, because they have given some awards to good people, deserving sure. organizations in the past, and it really discredits the award in a way.
Well,
going back to what I was saying, I hope your listeners are aware of how the war in Syria has done direct damage to many Canadians, and hundreds of Canadians have been, you know, misled and have traveled through Turkey to Syria and died. I talked at length with the mother of Damien Claremont. And that woman is so courageous, and CSIS did nothing. Canadian Security Services they knew exactly what was going on. They gave him a new passport 2 months before Damien left. Damien was, you know, kind of a troubled 19 or 20-year-old, and he got brainwashed in a Saudi, probably Saudi-funded mosque in Calgary. He ended up going to Syria and being killed. Another Canadian went there and became a suicide bomber. And the Canadian government is complicit up to their neck in all of this that's gone on. It's been basically a coalition of Australia, Canada, the U.S., the U.K., France, Britain. In cahoots with the U.S., they have looked the other way, and they've actually colluded and assisted their youth being brainwashed and becoming jihadis, going to attack the people of Syria.
Well, Rick, a lot of Canadians, they look at Syria and they remember Maher Arar, the Canadian citizen who was kidnapped from the JFK, I believe it was, airport in New York City on the behest of the, or at least thanks to the work of our spy services here in Canada, taken to Syria and tortured. And Syria was used as a torture spot of convenience by Canada and the United States and its allies. People that hear us criticizing, say, the White Helmets or the resistance against the Assad regime might think we're apologists for Assad and saying that, oh, well, he's a nice guy and everything. But is there any white hats in Syria?
Yeah, there are. There's a lot of white hats. I've been there twice in the last 2 years. The Syrian people are wonderful. And, you know, it's really for the Syrian people to determine their government. I think the Maher Arar thing has been distorted highly. He was tortured, he was interrogated for a number of weeks, and then he was kept for another 10 months, and then the Syrians sent him back and said he's not a terrorist. My friends there say he is connected to the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, that's not a crime. Some sectarians in the Muslim faith have been influenced by the Wahhabi faith, and they are sectarian, and they have supported, they have allied with the U.S. In attacking, whether it's Afghanistan or now Syria. But the fact is that, I mean, Syria, whether it's Syria or Libya or Iraq, there's a real problem with extremism. And there's nothing wrong with interrogating people. Now, he was tortured, apparently. I don't know how severely it was, but that's not right. I'm not going to condone that or say that's right. But it's on a different order of things. I mean, how many years have the prisoners in Guantanamo been there?
Well, and we don't want to make equivalencies of sort, you know.
I guess my point is that the Syrian, it's really for the Syrian people. You know, it's a security. It's for them to decide whether they want to change their government or not. It's not for the U.S. or Canada to decide Assad must go.
Okay, well,
nor is it for Maher Arar, who came to Canada at age 19 or 20, I believe.
Well, okay, so Rick, now I went to the website to sign the petition to say, well, we should take away this Right Livelihood Award. But it wouldn't. It was really difficult. It wouldn't let me use my Facebook ID. Was that just me not being able to use the system, or is there a problem more generally with that? Have you heard anybody else complain?
Well, I've heard that some browsers are more problematic than others. You shouldn't have to. You don't have to enter. Go through Facebook or anything else. You just go to the site and scroll down, and you should be able to sign it. Now, I have heard. So don't do share on Facebook.
Okay.
You have to basically you've got to scroll down to the bottom.
Okay. Yeah, I tried to use.
You do not have to go on Twitter or Facebook or go or give them your name or address or any of that. You just it does take note of your IP. It does take note of your IP address because they don't, they can't allow people to sign multiple times.
Right, sure. Yeah, that's what, yeah.
But all the servers are that way.
Yeah, I was asking you.
I have heard that some browsers are a little more problematic than others, but you should not have to. So I would say if you can try it again, Chris, I would, appreciate it.
Yeah, I was using Firefox, and it was asking me for all those names and address and all this other stuff, and then it wouldn't recognize me anyway. Well, I misspoke earlier too, Rick. It wasn't the Current that talked to the doctor this morning. It was actually our local affiliate. And how things work up here, Rick, is because it is a network. They have one guest on, and he speaks to several different locations. So he'll talk to somebody in Fredericton, he'll talk to somebody in Edmonton, he'll talk to somebody in Victoria, and these different local hosts will ask the questions, but it's all part of what looks to me to be a campaign across television and radio here in Canada, at least, to lionize the White Helmets. And they mentioned, of course, the Right Livelihood Award as well as the Nobel.
Right. There's a ton of money being poured into this. This is a media campaign, Chris. You've got marketing companies. There's an outfit in New York called the Syria Campaign.
Right.
All right. It was created by the Asfari Foundation, which is a foundation set up by a billionaire, and which is also promoted through the State Department. they've been pumping tons of money, and if you go online, if you go on Twitter, if you go on social media, they are there, and they are doing everything they can to promote the white helmet.
Well, Rick, listen, I've run over time. I lost track of the clock here. I'm sorry, but I'll have to cut it short. Go to my website, pacificfreepress.com or guerrilla-radio.com, and there'll be contacts to Rick's organization as well and more on this. Thanks a lot, Rick, for coming on again and talking, eh?
That interview originally aired on CFUV 101.9 FM on the September 28th edition of Guerrilla Radio. Find the original podcast at www.guerrilla-radio.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Making his debut on the Global Research News Hour is Mark Taliano. He's a retired high school teacher who has turned his attention to writing and activism, and he contributes frequently to the Global Research website and has just returned from a trip to Syria. He joins us from Grimsby, Ontario, in the Niagara region in Canada. Thanks for joining us, Mark, and welcome.
Yeah, nice to be talking with you.
Sure thing. So I'm curious to hear about what you were exposed to while you were in Syria. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about where you traveled and for how long?
Okay, well, I was there for about a week, and I was picked up in Beirut, and we drove from Beirut to Syria, to Old Damascus, and it's absolutely gorgeous, Old Damascus, and we stayed in a five-star hotel. Everything is, it radiates history and civilization. And it keeps Damascus, the whole area keeps its past, and its ancient past, and its holy past, and it celebrates it as it moves forward, mm-hmm. which is not so easy now that there's a bombing campaign by Western-backed terrorists. But everything is also distinctive. It's not, it doesn't have the, thank goodness, it doesn't have the North American neoliberal economic model type flavor. There's a gorgeous, Syria is renowned for its spice markets, its souks, and they were unbelievable. They're filled with people of all sorts of different people. There's all sorts of different spices, and I couldn't name them all, but they're there. And, and if I were to go back again, I would start to learn them a bit better and incorporate them into my own life.
How would you...
So it's totally unique. You don't see a McDonald's. You don't see a Burger King. You don't see any of these fixings of our current form of capitalism, which wants to spread its uniform parasitical tentacles around the whole world. Syria is resisting that, thank goodness. And that's why it was so refreshing, because it's so different. Because of the nature of the people, they're very friendly and open. And because of their high education levels, education and healthcare are free there, and they still are, believe it or not, despite the bombings and the sanctions. And so the communication lines are, for the most part, quite open. The atmosphere is also a bit fearful, especially when we heard bombings. And then I felt somewhat like a Syrian might feel, somewhat violated and threatened that, for example, the Western-backed terrorists will, on this particular incident, they were firing explosive bullets, and they fire them in such a way that they arc and then fall down in a haphazard fashion. And where they land, they kill people if people are there.
Oh my.
And then the response to that was heavy... boom, boom, thundering artillery from the Syrian Arab army. And when I asked the day later, you know, what happened, and that was that scene that I just described to you was described, I felt relieved, because these, even though I was there for a short period of time, there's always hanging over your head this threat and this violation. These people are violating. These terrorists are horrible. I've seen the damage that they do. I saw it personally. They have no respect for anyone or anything or any ideology that is different. And they want to erase history so that they can create their own deviant form of Wahhabism, which is totally misogynist. In terrorist-occupied areas, the women have to wear burqas. The kids are sent and indoctrinated.
Mm-hmm. But talking about the terrorist or the rebels, as they're called in Western circles, I'm wondering what you're hearing from other Syrians, and maybe you could even expand on your own observations about what they are actually doing and how they are seen by the people around you.
Okay, when I was there, and I did meet Syrian soldiers, and I was very grateful of that, and there were a lot of military checkpoints, and I was very grateful of that. And every Syrian I talked to, and I talked to a number of them, and they all see the government as protecting them. And I felt that too. I felt that, you know, I really wanted government protection. And for example, when I was sitting in a hotel, on the last day, I asked, you know, what kind of protection do we have? What would happen if the terrorists came in, sort of thing? And he said that the Syrian army, you know, it's right around the corner. And there are also volunteer civil defense units, including women, with their AK-47s sitting here and there. They don't want their pictures taken. I don't blame them. And they're there just in case something happens. These people are volunteering and protecting their city. And a lot of these people, too many of these people, have directly been impacted in a tragic fashion by this. One person I talked to, he had a bullet wound. He had a cousin who was still captive. He from like the terrorists kidnapped him. I think he was a soldier, so he might be digging tunnels for his terrorists because you know they use this slave type labor. Another was in the army, and suicide bombers exploded, and he lost a leg. His brother, I think, was kidnapped, and they ruined his knee, so he can't walk. Maybe sometime they'll, you know, get surgery to fix him if possible. And there's more, like if I were sitting down with my notes, I could tell you in more details. But these stories are all too common, where Syrians themselves are affected tragically by this, and they've lost family members. The Grand Mufti's son was assassinated. We met him. The Minister of Reconciliation, his son was killed, I believe by a random mortar. But the toll on these people is unbelievable. Like the horrible toll. It's one person said that it's worse than one Palestinian said that. So Palestinians, for example, there's a lot of refugees there. They are treated just like Syrians. Unlike in Lebanon, where they have no rights, in Syria, the Palestinians have every right as a citizen, except not exactly Syrian citizenship, because there's always a hope that they can return to Palestine. But that's really symbolic and indicative of the Syrian society. It's all-inclusive, it's tolerant, it's pluralist, it's secular, and it welcomes all sorts of refugees, and they don't screen them. And they come from Iraq, they come from Palestine, they come from everywhere, and they don't put them in tents, they put them in, you know, buildings, and they can work and thrive and become Syrians. Totally different from, for example, in Lebanon, a friend of mine who was on the tour, he toured this refugee camp where Wasim lives. He just said it was unspeakable. It's just horrible.
Yeah. Could you talk about? It's interesting because when people out in Canada and the United States think about Syrians, they think about refugees leaving there. We don't think of them as becoming a place for refugees to go.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you could talk about the
Yes. Okay, so when terrorists come to town, they do brutal things, savage things. They throw people off buildings. They use people as human shields. If people don't, you know, if they want, they slaughter Christians. If people don't abide by their ideology, they are killed. And there's a threat of violence over everybody. And the women have to wear burqas and so on. The kids are sent to these schools where they're indoctrinated or they aren't educated at all. So if people leave, they leave toward, if they can, towards government-controlled areas where it's safe. And they're called internally displaced people. Most do that. So Damascus is an ancient city. It's continuously inhabited for over 4,000 years, and yet its population has grown tremendously from internally displaced people who are refugees who seek refuge from the terrorist occupied areas. And so they go to places in Syria that are controlled and protected by the government. Some don't make it out. Some choose to stay. But like I said, anyone, I didn't talk to anyone who would prefer to live in a terrorist occupied area. Nobody.
Okay. Now, I was wondering if you could talk about what you're hearing, their impressions of what Russia and the United States, these foreign powers, and their involvement in the country.
They're aware of what's going on. The ones that I talked to, they know what's going on. And they also, a common theme, refrain, because they've lived with this forever, is, and they're not afraid to say it, it's Israel. And it's also America. They know who's bombing. I mean, when America was bombing, when the coalition was illegally bombing Syria, ISIS territory expanded. When the ISIS was moving across the open desert in convoys of Toyota trucks, they were protected. They weren't bombed. Like, for example, the troops leaving Iraq who had signed an agreement for peace, the U.S. carpet bombed them and slaughtered them all. Well, they left ISIS alone, and therefore they protect ISIS. And this whole notion of moderate terrorists is a CIA psyop. They're all terrorists, and Syrians see them all as terrorists. There is infighting between groups, and the groups call themselves different names, and sometimes Al-Qaeda is Al-Nusra Front there, and now it's something else. That's part of the deception campaign. But they all have the same goals, which is toppling, the same goal as Canada, which is regime change, which is totally illegal. But the Syrians know that the alternative, first of all, I didn't talk to any Syrian who did not support the government. And we talked to opposition members as well. They all support the government. And one of the reasons for that is they know what the alternative is. The alternative is Libya or Iraq. The alternative is rule by these people who have no tolerance for culture, it's like a deviant mindset. And Syrians know this.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't talk to anyone who would prefer that type of rule. Now, there are people, but the problem is, one of the problems is, the illegal economic sanctions, that's also a form of war. I mean, they shipped out all sorts of machinery out of Aleppo and sent it to Turkey. They destroy everything they touch or they sell it. And, I mean, hospitals, I wanted to tour a hospital, but we couldn't fit in. I don't know if that was a security issue, but for example, MRIs, they can't do them because they can't get spare parts. They can't get spare parts for what ever factories aren't destroyed. Mm-hmm. So there's extraordinarily difficult times there, and people have to support their families and so on, and it's hard to do. And the Gulf states and so forth are trying to are corrupting people with their money. And that's the whole idea, to divide and balkanize and destroy the country. But overall, it isn't working.
I really appreciate those on-the-ground perspectives, and I know that you've written quite a few articles that are available on the Global Research website.
Yep, and we're putting together a book as well.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Mark Taliano, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Mark Taliano. He's a writer and activist, and you can read his work currently at the Global Research website. Tensions continue to mount in Syria following the failure of a ceasefire agreement brokered by Russia and the United States. Through our media, we hear reports about an accidental airstrike by U.S. forces killing 62 Syrian troops on September 16th. We hear about Russians deliberately targeting civilians and the Syrian president bombing and starving his own people. Joining us to discuss these and related matters is frequent guest and Global Research contributor Stephen Lendman. He's a Chicago-based broadcaster and hosts the Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network 3 times a week. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, Stephen Lendman.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's always great to be on with you.
What do you make of the hostility that's being expressed recently by U.S. Representative to the U.N. Samantha Power, accusing Assad of wanting to take every square inch of his own country back, as if that's a bad thing for a sovereign country to want to do, and the crosswords with her Russian counterpart in the wake of the attack that killed Syrian soldiers, and the resulting breakdown of the ceasefire agreement? Is there an actual logic to all of this, or are these people just acting recklessly?
Oh, there certainly is a logic to it, and I've locked horns with Samantha Power a few times, including her recent histrionics in the Security Council. But propaganda works. It's throughout the major media, and you hear it from U.S. officials, other Western officials, even so-called progressive media, claiming to be progressive media. Some of them are really not that at all. They'll go cover some issues very respectably, and others, they go along with the party line, especially the war on Syria or any of America's wars. They'll go along with them. It really is terrible. And you repeat the big lies often enough, and if people don't go to real credible alternative sources, they know nothing else, and they believe this stuff. So it keeps going because it works, Michael, and as long as it works, America gets away with murder.
I'm looking at the campaign, like the Russians and the Syrians, and they do seem to be taking out ISIS fairly effectively. So probably regular readers of your blog and listeners to this program understand those links between ISIS and these terrorist groups and U.S. imperial ambitions. So that does seem to be a loss from the U.S. side. But I suppose, like, what does that mean that we're leading into? Is the ante being upped from the U.S. side?
I think it is being the ante is being upped, and I greatly fear. I think everybody should fear the prospect of Hillary Clinton succeeding Obama, Michael, a war goddess. I mean, just a despicable character. I fear that the groundwork is being laid to escalate the war significantly once she takes over in January, and it certainly looks like that's going to be the case with the media one-sidedly supporting her. Inventing reasons to bash Trump, who's no paragon of virtue by any means. But compared to Hillary, I must say I would prefer him. We have no idea what he would do, but we certainly know what Hillary will do. And I absolutely believe she will escalate the war. But the real serious thing is going from Syria to a direct confrontation with Russia that could end up as a nuclear confrontation. And I fear that very, very greatly. I think the possibility is very great to that something like that could happen. And if it ever did, I mean, a nuclear war is something that nobody can win. Humanity is the loser. And it's just shocking the kind of policies that America is pursuing. There really is a dead end, Michael, with maybe the destruction of humanity and everything else, everything living on the planet, if this stuff, if we don't find a way to stop this stuff. And you could go back to the wisdom that was expressed by people like Bertrand Russell and Albert Einstein. You know, we have a choice. We can either stop this nonsense, or we're going to kill ourselves.
You brought up Hillary, and I guess that kind of, I'm kind of tempted to find out, like, in terms of the presidential election and the recent debate, and I don't want to get too bogged down with that kind of circus, but I'm wondering to what extent the media coverage and the media hype around the presidential election is playing into this other campaign, the campaign against Assad and to a certain extent Russia.
Oh, to a great extent, it'd be Russia. My God, the New York Times wrote an editorial yesterday calling Russia an outlaw nation, of course, bashing Putin just viciously. And, I mean, follow-up articles of this kind of stuff all the time. I mean, it's just going at him hammer and tong. And, I mean, there's nobody I know who's more dedicated to world peace and stability. He's tried so hard, Sergei Lavrov, his foreign minister, the two of them trying so hard to resolve the Syrian conflict, the Ukrainian conflict, and America undermines everything. But you get a one-sided report of the media, Michael, as we know, and Putin gets bashed, and there's nothing said about America's imperial agenda and the wars that it instigates against non-belligerent countries. The war against Syria alone. Syria didn't threaten anybody, didn't attack anybody. The last time Syria was in a war was the 1973 Yom Kippur War. My God, 43 years ago. I remember that very, very well. I remember where I was, as a matter of fact. But since then, Syria hasn't attacked anybody, certainly hasn't attacked anybody under Bashar Assad, and he was overwhelmingly reelected. The Syrians want nobody else leading him, but the reports in the major media, of course, Michael, we know, are exactly the opposite. He's the bad guy, and America is the good guy.
Now, but it was a Fars news story talking about an intelligence facility being attacked by Russia.
Yes.
And that there's some significance there. That's a really, it seems to be a very important piece of the puzzle if we're going to understand, you know, what this, you know, the U.S.-Russia hostilities, a flashpoint. Do you want to share some of your own thoughts about that?
Oh, yeah. I wrote very briefly about it, indeed. I guess you could call it a command center, operations center, with maybe 30 individuals or so in it from America.
And
from,
several countries.
Turkey, yeah. Israel, I think Britain. I mean, Russia knew this, apparently, and yet they attacked it. I guess they have excellent intelligence. They attacked it, and they killed these people. It may have been a shot across the bow, Michael, letting America know that, you know, I mean, you want to take this thing to an extreme. We're letting you know that we mean business, and if you want to go at us, we'll come right back at you, and we can do it. And I think that might have been the message of what happened. I saw nothing in the major media about this.
No. And that's, you know, of course, quite significant because, you know, if it's like, I think I agree with what you're saying. It's as if there's a determination that if, you know, the United States is determined to pursue this course, there are various different ways and means that they can retaliate.
Absolutely. Michael, I think I'm out on a limb with one belief that I have, and I've said it in a number of articles, that I really believe diplomacy is futile because years of Russian diplomacy on Syria, the last 2 years on Ukraine, America has undermined everything that Russia has tried to do. So I think the talks between Russia and America could go on endlessly, and America will keep undermining it. And I think attacking the humanitarian convoy, which obviously was done by U.S.-supported terrorists, and America's attack on the Syrian troops, and the death toll I read got up to 82, maybe up maybe 80 or 100 more injured. There was nothing accidental about this. American who was there, they knew the targets, and apparently the attack went on for close to an hour, and Russia notified America of the attack, but they just keep going, killing these soldiers. I think this was a deliberate attempt to undermine any peace efforts, and I think no matter what Russia does, we're going to see repeats of this, and it's an excuse, Michael, to blame Russia for U.S. crimes.
Mm-hmm. And yet they seem to be, like, the media coverage has been so efficient at containing these inconvenient truths. It's really quite remarkable.
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, I really feel, I hate to say this, but I really believe, because of the way America operates, that the only way to liberate Syria is on the battlefield. Maybe if Russia inflicts enough damage to U.S. interests and really blasts the devil out of the terrorists that America is supporting, maybe America will finally get the message, and I've made this comment a few times, that the only language America understands is force. Well, Russia needs to give it a good taste of force, and maybe then there could be a chance for diplomacy. But at this moment, Michael, I see no chance whatsoever.
Well, there was just a recent announcement, Ashton Carter in Minot, basically
yes.
Advertising the new nuclear policy. I don't know how much of that is messaging toward Russia, or if it's just some sort of a preparation of the American people for some sort of an increased military escalation.
I think the public is being massaged to get them ready for whatever America decides to do. I don't know that there's been any decision made on what they're going to do. You know, should we attack Russia? Should we attack China? My goodness, the kind of discussions you can imagine must go on. So, you know, I mean, I guess what they do is they come up with all the options that they could consider, and they probably draw up alternative plans, keep them on the shelf, and then they can pull the one off that they want to implement. But I'm sure the plans include waging war on Russia, on Iran, on China, and if we ever get into a war with Russia and China, it's going to be a nuclear war. And if it's a nuclear war, it's curtains, Michael. I mean, Russia will hit back if they're going to be hit. And it's a very, very scary situation. Very briefly, I'm not a big movie fan, but the old film of the 1960s, Failsafe, was on television earlier in the week, and I saw part of it, including the ending of it. And the ending of that film with Henry Fonda playing the U.S. president, the ending of the film was a U.S. bomber was getting through with no way to stop it, nuking Moscow, and the only way America could get Moscow to stop launching a nuclear war in America was for the U.S. president to say, we're going to fly a U.S. Warplane over New York City with a nuclear warhead, and if that plane gets through and nukes Moscow, we will nuke New York City, and the way the film ends is both cities are nuked. Well, that's what's coming, Michael, if we don't find a way to stop this stuff.
Well, okay, then, that leads me to my next and last question. Is there any prospect of popular resistance somehow springing up and taking us back from the brink, or are we all just captives of this propaganda campaign?
I don't see a hint of the public being even aware of what the devil is going on. And even most of the ones aware of it are kind of indifferent, dismissive. They're not doing anything about it. I remember well the anti-war protests in the 60s and 70s. There's none of that going on now. I mean, that, what was happening there was nothing compared to the dangers we face today. I mean, people should be protesting in the streets every single day, demanding an end to this insanity, because if it doesn't stop, I really fear the worst, Michael. We could have a nuclear war, and then you'll be gone, and I'll be gone, and we'll all be gone.
Hmm. So another Cuban Missile Crisis.
Except the real thing, the trigger will be pulled and it'll be curtains.
Well, on that rather ominous note, I want to thank you, Stephen Lenman, for coming in and sharing these perspectives on these developing events.
Oh, thank you, Michael. I hope we're both alive and breathing and able to do this again.
Absolutely. I've been speaking with Stephen Lenman, Chicago-based broadcaster, host of the Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network, and he's also a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks to Chris Cook and Victoria Radio Station CFUV 101.9's Guerrilla Radio for supplying the audio from the Rick Sperling interview. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.